Hi, everyone, and welcome to Radio Cloud Native from Mirantis, where we break down the week's news on Kubernetes, the cloud native ecosystem, and the wider world of tech. I'm Eric Gregory.
And I'm John Janchik.
This week, we're talking new releases for Istio, Fedora, and Dino, OpenStack's 2022 user survey, and turning off the microservices. Sorry to say, John, but we've got to cut 80% of those microservices by the end of the podcast.
Which 80% is the question?
But first, a quick programming note. John's been stepping in as sort of an extended term sub for Nick here at the moment, but he also has a solo gig as host of our sister show, Cloud Native and Coffee. And man, you had some real meaty, fascinating interviews from KubeCon last week with folks like Madhur Yetri from Elodl talking about nodeless Kubernetes and the wild things that are possible there.
We had a lot of fun doing that episode, which was really, you know, kind of walking around talking with interesting people. I recommend that you take a look at it because we found some interesting, you know, things that I think are trend worthy as well. They will creep into the news, I suspect, next year as people recognize how much traction some of these ideas have. But at the moment, it's very easy to miss some of these companies. They're so small. They're so nascent. They're, you know, evolving a company out of an open source project. And it's really the most pleasant time to talk to folks. When they're still, you know, they're totally into what they're doing, what they're building, a team. They love the people they work with. And they're just kind of enchanted by the first steps. It isn't painful yet of the kind of funding process, and you know, which burns down founders, let's face it. You know, technology founders would often much rather be sitting in front of their computers, you know, cutting code.
Yeah, it's a delight of an episode. Folks, if you're listening to the podcast, that was just the last episode in the feed. But if you're with us live or on video, make sure to check that out. It's on the podcast feed, it's on the Mirantis LinkedIn feed, or on the Mirantis channel on YouTube. All right. So turning to the news for the week, do you want to start us off?
I will indeed. We obviously like to blow our own horn, but it's always a pleasure seeing when other people actually volunteer to blow our horn for us. I was looking for a few last news items, and I happened on an article that got published on the Newstack yesterday by a very good tech journalist, Ann Thrift, about Mirantis customer Choosel, who run a sophisticated digital advertising platform that unifies access to customer data across different media and sources. Choosel leveraged Mirantis professional services and DevOps care to help evaluate Kubernetes service providers. Then they managed a complex move to Kubernetes, Google Kubernetes Engine from AWS. And then, you know, they modernized and now operate CI/CD and DevSecOps workflows on that new platform with the help of Lens Autopilot, which is a service that delivers incremental metrics-based improvements in capacity management, continuous integration, continuous delivery, security, uptime, and issue resolution. The article quotes Michael Baldessari, their director of Choosel, director of product and engineering operations, as saying, "We were struggling to hire DevOps talent. We didn't have the capacity in our existing team to keep operating as DevOps engineers as well as software engineers." And I guess this is a familiar problem to a lot of small companies. Instead, the article notes, Mirantis Service provided DevOps engineers that knew Choosel's stack and could prioritize solutions as well as execute them in some cases. The Autopilot team has implemented automated load monitoring, dynamic scaling that's now saving Choosel some money in their direct provider costs, eliminating the need for precautionary overscaling. But the big win, they say, is that Choosel doesn't need to maintain specialized DevOps folks and keep them on call 24/7. And this is enabling Choosel to focus on value. They're building an entirely new version of their application now, which they intend to run in tandem with the existing system to simplify transition for customers. So it seems to be a win. And thank you very much, the new stack and Thrift, for paying attention to us.
Yeah, always nice to see a story like that in the wild. Elsewhere, Istio announced the release of version 1.16 this week. The new release brings the Service Mesh's Gateway API implementation into beta, which is exciting. As the release blog says, quote, "This is a significant step toward our goal of making the Gateway API the default API for traffic management in the future," unquote. Other new features include support for the OpenTelemetry tracing provider and experimental HBone protocol support for container sidecars and ingress gateways. HBone provides a way to create a network overlay environment that enables end-to-end security via MTLS and supports metadata and is compatible with HTTP infrastructure. Here it's being used specifically for tunneling with sidecars or ingress gateways.
In security news, it's always nice to read about something that has had no practical impact in the wild and gets fixed instantaneously. So this is one of those good news exploit discovered and repaired stories. If you haven't heard about it, this is about Spotify's Backstage, which is a CNCF incubating project. Backstage is a toolkit for building developer portals that pull together code, YAML code descriptions, human-readable documentation, a complete build system that you can replace if you like, and plugins that let you hook up tooling, observability, and other useful stuff. And it all exists in one sleek web interface. 5 or 6 years ago, I guess, when app catalogs were suddenly the focus of lots of attention on IaaS platforms, mostly, people often said, wow, this would be really great if this app catalog could be expanded and standardized and made useful, and then we would all share apps through app catalog. And it was, but Backstage has basically done this. They've created one unified solution to encourage code reuse and support composability within an organization, while enabling organizations to also codify and require standards of developers. So it's a tool for both sharing and reasonable levels of control. Developers, understandably kind of love it. And it's beautiful to work with. It's worth checking out their online demo, which is minimal, but quite informative and really, they hand you a tiny little instance of the project of the product to play with, and it all seems to work until you dig too deep. Sample artifact repos and the main code base to see what Backstage does and what it requires to work. Sadly, there is a cost to popularity. Oxeye Security yesterday reported discovery of an exploit that lets an attacker run shell commands in a Backstage environment. The exploit builds on earlier Oxeye work that showed how to use the Nunjux JavaScript templating engine to enable shell command execution in Backstage. This vulnerability Backstage had already mitigated by implementing the popular VM2 sandbox engine in its core scaffolder plugin. Oxeye's new gambit, new discovery, uses Nunjux again, but also uses a VM2 specific sandbox escape before repeating its old trick and executing code. Mm-hmm. This idea of template-based attacks is very interesting. Meanwhile, but more on that in a second. The good news: Spotify instantly patched the vulnerability and released version 1.5.1 of the code yesterday. So very good on them and on the project. No emergency here. Yuval Ostrovsky, software architect at Oxeye, recommends that users of Backstage and potentially anything else that could possibly use templating engines should probably avoid using template engines that let you put logic into templates. The trick of protecting yourself seems to be to favor logicless templates like Mustache that don't present the same vulnerabilities because they don't permit flow control in templates and they make it impossible to mix logic and presentation together.
Makes sense. Well, speaking of exploits, at GitHub Universe 2022, GitHub announced a new process for security researchers to discreetly report a vulnerability to a public repository. Basically, this creates a standard communication pathway for security reporting, so it's not happening haphazardly or out in the open where the issue might prematurely creep into the public eye and get exploited. This is an optional feature that anyone with admin privileges can configure on a public repo. When maintainers enable the feature, it creates a button on the security advisories repo page that security folks can use to report. And pivoting from new features to mothballed services, real natural segue here. According to an exclusive from the Register, IBM will discontinue its Watson IoT platform, with the service and its API becoming unavailable on December 1st, 2023, without a replacement. The platform was intended to act as a centralized point of management for IoT devices, enabling companies to manage and monitor devices and collect data at industrial scale. It also made a big deal of using blockchain, quote, for intelligent and secure tracking, traceability, and smart contracts, unquote. The Watson IoT platform sunset comes in the wake of Google's retirement of Google Cloud IoT Core, which, John, you and I discussed back in August. Mm-hmm. IoT Core had a pretty similar value proposition and is pretty similarly going into forced retirement in August of next year. What do you make of another one of these IoT-specific offerings getting shuttered?
I'd have to read further into this, but as I recall from the Google story, they made a market-based decision that others, you know, people other than them could handle this problem better. That right. Ultimately, it was a more specialized game than Google was interested in committing to. And certainly, there are companies out there. I believe at the time we included in the story the names of a couple of them worth watching that were in fact doing a more focused, better job, you know, than Google. Of providing the IoT functionality and, of course, the security and other things that you need in order to run, you know, a platform like this, you know, at scale and safely for customers. I wonder if this is the same thing. You would think that a company with IBM's depth of sophistication and experience in delivering cloud services, certainly at scale. Would not have walked into that, into that same trap, but sometimes these business traps are, you know, they're just sitting there waiting to gobble people up.
Indeed. Well, speaking of being gobbled up, I guess we have to, we have to hit the week's unavoidable story, right?
That was a great one. Yeah. Well, okay. All right. So, We didn't report on this last week, and I'm kind of glad we didn't, but this week it feels obligatory to talk about Twitter's blue tick for Ka and Twitter 2.0 and other news emerging from the Twitter sphere. Every developer, certainly, everybody in the world, or at least the extremely online ones, are watching Elon Musk of Tesla and SpaceX and the Boring Company, et cetera, fame, take over at Twitter. With a weird mix of emotions, it's been a very strange 2 weeks at the Bird app. And what emotions you feel, I guess, depend partly on whether you're inside or outside the blast radius on any given day. The weirdest aspect, of course, is that the whole thing is being narrated on Twitter more or less in real time. So if you actually have time to, you know, skim your timeline, you can watch the thrashing in, you know, as if it were a movie. It's fascinating. A couple of weeks ago, Musk moved in and started by letting go of leadership, of course. Then came the rumors of impending massive layoffs. Then, last week, a marvelous false alarm, which turned out to be a real alarm, amplified by two brilliant trolls who drove by Twitter HQ with cardboard boxes of office junk and pretended to be among the first Twitter employees to be let go. Their story was eagerly swallowed by gathering journalists. Who turned these icons, who called themselves Rahul Ligma and Daniel Johnson, into instant global celebrities of engineering victimhood. And Johnson's deadpan line, "I've got to touch base with my wife and my husband," will live forever. And marks the start of a week where polycules and tech have collided multiple times. I know we are not reporting on that story this week, but, you know, maybe next week, right? Then the real layoffs started. Twitter pink-slipped about half its staff, cutting whole business functions, including legal, governance, transparency, anti-abuse, anti-bot units, stuff of arguably enormous political and concrete importance for an application that plays a central role in global public discourse. And this began a flood of advertiser defections, folks deciding that they didn't want to take the risk of associating their organizations with a brand that might quickly again become a powerful tool for disinformation and political manipulation. A slew of engineering staffs and positions were eliminated in the process as well. Initially, it seemed making naive use of a lines of code written in the past year metric, complete with real-time reports on Twitter that the Tesla engineers Musk had tasked with evaluating staff had asked Twitter devs to print out their recent commits so that Musk himself could evaluate them. This was quickly withdrawn. At this point, people outside the company aren't sure if there was a lot of rhyme or reason to who got to stay or had to go. One's impression, tweets posted by stayers, as well as former alumni uninvolved in the current situation who knew people who were asked to go, have been uniformly supportive. And one gets the impression that a great deal of very, very talented folks are now looking for their next opportunity. Yeah. Don't ignore them. There were many tweets by individual engineers and let go leads that critical Twitter functionalities now had basically nobody to maintain them, and suggestions that the engineering bench needed to keep the service on its feet was now gone. Then Musk ordered remaining engineers to field a new plan to charge $8 a month for the coveted blue checks that previously signified a formally validated account, i.e. that of a notable person like a real Donald Trump. The new program started, and within the first 24 hours, trolls had exploited it to roll up highly credible-looking fake Twitter accounts for organizations like global insulin market leader Eli Lilly, tweeting things like, insulin will be free now, and sending Lilly's stock price and the prices of other insulin makers into short-term freefall. The new blue check program was undone, I believe 48 hours after it started, and Musk yesterday tweeted it would be re-implemented around November 29th in hopes of making it presumably less easily exploited by malicious actors. Since then, Musk has taken to Twitter daily, having high-profile arguments with remaining staff about how to fix performance issues and firing those who disagree with him or point out his understandable, still rudimentary understanding of Twitter's architecture. It continues being very weird, and over the past 24 hours, users have started being impacted by point failures in Twitter's accustomed functionality. For example, the failure of SMS-based two-factor authentication on some platforms. Last night, in an email to employees instantly leaked, Musk asked all remaining Twitter folks to click a button indicating consent to what sounds like a We Reach the Moon effort to create Twitter 2.0, an effort Musk describes as likely going to be very, very hardcore. One bright spot, yesterday Musk entertained the trolls Rahul Ligma and Daniel Johnson at headquarters and says he's rehired them, despite neither of them having worked at Twitter before. More news as it happens and happens and happens. One cannot look away.
Oof. Well, things are going well, and presumably we'll continue to just keep on impressing everyone the world over. Pivoting somehow, I don't have a segue here. would-be Node.js successor Dino released version 1.28, which is a pretty big milestone in the Node succession wars, since it brings along stabilized NPM support and around 1.3 million NPM modules with it. For JavaScript devs who want to hit the ground running with Dino, this is obviously a big and important expansion of the toolbox, but you can also see it as a bit of a concession. From the start, the Dino project has been vocally interested in correcting what they see as some of Node's errors, including using the CommonJS module system. Dino sets out to use ECMA script modules instead, which provides standardized native browser support. Now with NPM support in Dino, Dino devs have access to an alluring buffet of naughty, largely common JS modules just sitting there waiting to be tasted. Stabilized NPM support is coming through a new Dino standard library, std/node, which facilitates the integration of NPM modules via NPM specifiers and handles compatibility with CommonJS modules. Notably, this does not create a node modules directory as in Node, and there's no NPM install command. Instead, NPM packages live in a central global NPM cache. Alternatively, and less recommendedly, you can import NPM modules via a content delivery network, but this older approach is limited to ESM packages, and compatibility with any given module is bound to be dicey. If you'd like to learn more about this update, you can check out the Dino blog at dino.land/manual/node.
That's really interesting. Have you tried Dino?
A little bit. I played around a little bit, not with this latest release, but yeah, it's... it's exciting. I'm enjoying sort of tooling around with both Dino and Bun, and I'm really curious to see where both of them go. It's kind of fun to have them duking it out, trying to take the throne.
I have to jump on this. I it's funny how what project you have in front of you tends to dictate what you know in later life. You know, I went through a period a couple of years ago where I just learned everything there was to know about Node and lived and breathed and breathed and lived and lived and breathed, you know, and then that project came to an end, and my cat just jumped on the counter and knocked everything on the floor, and now I don't know anything about Node, you know, nothing at all.
Yeah.
So I'm glad you said something, because I thought the cat might have completely unplugged me. It is quite amazing having live animals running your life.
Cat came over.
So, let me talk to you about momentarily about Fedora Linux 37. This is, in a sense, my favorite, and it's certainly the most wholesome story that we're writing this week. Fedora yesterday released version 37 of their Linux in many versions for many platforms, and it looks like the usual dependable solid job. They've added two new what they call additions, including a CoreOS Atomic ultralight self-updating well backable cloud image based on the CoreOS Atomic work, and a more complete general purpose cloud edition. Their desktop workstation includes version 43 of GNOME with a new security panel and updated versions of many GNOME core applications now ported to use GTK for graphics and sporting a brand new look. They have also updated their OS spins, including Fedora Comp Neuro for computational neuroscience and LXQT for a more lightweight desktop environment. And they make everything available for multiple CPU platforms, including ARM64 Power and S390X. The really small news, or big news for some, is that Fedora 37 now supports Raspberry Pi 4 out of the box with graphics acceleration, which increases the number of fully modern Linuxes you can easily install and use on that platform. Seems like a win.
Yeah, that's exciting. I'll definitely be trying that out. Last but not least, we have a late-breaking story with the Open Infra Foundation just this morning releasing their 2022 OpenStack User Survey. Their headline reads, OpenStack is more alive than ever with 40 million cores in production and over 300 public cloud data centers worldwide. This year's survey reflects data on more than 300 deployments and is based on feedback from over 400 respondents. Survey finds that the Loki stack, which as Nick talked about a couple months ago, refers to the Linux OpenStack Kubernetes infrastructure stack, is being used more and more, with Kubernetes now deployed on more than 85% of OpenStack deployments. OpenStack deployments now have 40 million compute cores in production, a 60% increase over 2021 and a 166% increase since 2020. And hybrid cloud usage with OpenStack deployments rose from 77% to 80%. Just off the top of your head, any thoughts on those numbers, John?
Obviously, it makes sense to us. I mean, this rationalizes a lot of what Mirantis is certainly doing and saying around these technologies. Loki simply makes sense. I mean, why would you want to run Kubernetes anywhere? I mean, this is assuming that you want to run it, in an on-premises cloud. Why would you not want to run that on something that you can so easily dynamically control underneath it? I'm certainly pleased and not surprised because, these numbers are, tracking linearly on numbers from last year and the year before. But 40 million compute cores is a lot of cores. It's nice to think that all that OpenStack is out there. The hybrid cloud stuff is interesting. We certainly have been watching movements towards repatriation. In some cases, people are pulling back from what they find are unaffordable public cloud deployments and building on-premises clouds that will give them better utilization and value for money. On the other hand, there's motion in the opposite direction too, where, particularly in situations where one can apply a common regime, for example, to Kubernetes cluster architectures running on a public cloud environment, that are the same as what runs on a premises environment. So you actually have the possibility of seamless federation and ability to genuinely move workloads from one environment to the other without driving yourself nuts. So that's what I think anyway.
I reckon that does us for this week. So everyone, next week is Thanksgiving here in the United States, and we're going to be taking a two-week break. So that means our next live show will be December 7th, and the podcast will go live as usual the following Friday. Thanks, as always, to producer Nika and to Lewis and DJ on social and video, and we hope all of y'all have an excellent and restful 2 weeks where you can look at Twitter as much or as little as you want. take care.
Happy Thanksgiving, everyone.